You are listening to the News Project in Studio, brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome to another edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director here at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today. Today is Monday, April 29th, and it's also a pleasure to be joined here in the studio by Representative Linda Joy Sullivan, who represents the towns of Dorset, Danby, Mount Tabor, Landgrove, and Peru in the state legislature, and is, of course, no stranger to the GNAT TV studio.
Thank you for having me here.
Representative Sullivan, welcome back. So let's get started. A lot of ground to cover here. A couple of the big bills that are still kind of awaiting finalization are the minimum wage bill, the family leave bill, the tax and regulate of cannabis bill, school-led water testing. There are several others. One of the ones that's been discussed a lot, and I know at an earlier time, earlier this year, you were here when we talked about the minimum wage bill. That was one that seemed to be kind of, you know, moving forward pretty quickly, but has hit a few, roadblocks along the way to the governor's desk. Sounds like there's still some questions about that. And one that came up recently was this business about, I guess it's, the term is wage compression. Medicaid workers, the idea would be that they should get a little bit of a bump up in salary too as we progress forward to the $15 minimum wage by 2024. But some of your colleagues up there are thinking that, well, they should get a little bit more to, you know, sort of be paid at a somewhat higher rate than what a minimum wage would be. But that runs into some $28 million, I think.
Right. Wage compression is pretty complex. You know, back in the day and still, you know, businesses have the right to pay raises as they see fit. So because somebody comes in at the new minimum wage, should it go into law, does not require somebody to have to bump everybody else up. That's a morale decision, a business decision, and how should you bump somebody up? I mean, there are other ways you can give bonuses and so on. Historically, when people applied for jobs, and I think today too, when you're younger and you go in, you start higher. And I think right now we're looking at more of the hourly employee versus a managerial position. So if we look at what's going on now, the minimum wage bill was in House General and they were reviewing it and really working to look at wage compression and if there should be specific groups that may feel the impact more. However, I think that you can't rush, once again, something like that through. So it's my understanding that that has been not chosen to go through with the Medicaid and other dollars, that they're going to push the bill out the way it was. Of course, that can always change on the floor or still with people coming with amendments. But wage compression is an issue unto itself, and it's not a mandate, but it can definitely cause some serious, you know, dollars to have to come out of the budget and pay attention to what we need to do. So that's the quandary. You know, do you let businesses decide? Do you force a particular population to have an increase? What's the spread? How does it work with the index? You know, there's all of these different issues, but wage compression is not something to not pay attention to. So do we pull it out now? I think it's going to move. I think that we have the issue of the minimum wage versus paid family leave. Can businesses swallow both? Will they both come out? Will the Senate release paid family leave and in what form? Will there be enough votes for minimum wage? And, you know, how many years will it progress over? Will it go into 2026 or will it happen sooner? So all of those issues are going to be faced on the floor. And of course, the Senate and House speaking together about which bill will have the votes to come out, and will they both make it? And then, of course, the governor steps in.
Well, last year, the minimum wage bill and the paid family leave bills were two of the bills that the governor vetoed right towards the end of the session. And I guess, what is your sense of where he's at this point this year? The governor advanced a voluntary paid family leave proposal in conjunction with New Hampshire. The House and Senate have come up with an alternative version that would be mandatory. Do you think that the governor is going to be okay signing off on something that is not a voluntary proposal?
Everybody wants a paid family leave bill. That's not a secret. But we have to be smart. So do I think the governor will move closer? I can see the governor saying, okay, if the terms of the bill are more closely aligned with something that's affordable and something that hits the majority of the people in Vermont, that helps them, there's a possibility that he may say, and I can't speak for him, of course, that let's start with a mandatory and then go to voluntary, or start with voluntary and go to mandatory, which would be his preference. So, and I quite honestly think that. I think you should start small, start with the voluntary, let's build our way up, and then get it to mandatory if it works. But we don't know if it's going to work. We don't even know what the bill says. So I think we need to wait and see, but if it makes it out. But I'm hoping that the Senate is going to be more moderate, more conservative in what they bring out, and look deeply into the details of the bill.
What is the projected price tag of the two of them put together? I guess we don't. It's too early to tell.
Tell, but we know that it's going to be mega millions of dollars, and I don't think we're in a position to even find the revenue to do that, or who we're going to hit. And the problem is, do we want more situations like the unfunded pension liability, which I didn't want to get into. do we want to get into a situation like that? And I don't think we need to do that right now, because we have all of these other employment benefits that are not funded, and we have to deal with this. We have to find appropriate revenue. I mean, there's been jokes around the State House of, should we tax coffee? You know, I mean, what are we going to tax? But that's what everybody drinks. So the key is, we need to start to be more conservative. We need to be more fiscally responsible, come up with solutions that actually work. Take a little bit longer. We're up there for 2 years. Let's get it right.
Right. Another big bill that has gotten a lot of discussion and attention is this tax and regulating of marijuana or cannabis, and this issue around roadside testing and saliva testing. I gather that's, the governor is very keen to see some kind of saliva test that would detect the presence of THC or whatever. But the problem, I guess, is that, you know, the presence may have been due to activity from last week. Where do you see this whole saliva test question going? It sounded like it was a bit of a compromise on the Senate side, anyway, to kind of say maybe we could do this if it was done correctly. But is this going to be a kind of a showstopper?
So I think that, remember, last term, saliva testing came up, and it never made it back from the Senate. It's now sitting in the Transportation Committee. It's a saliva testing bill. My thought is that they will end up putting it into the tax and regulate bill to satisfy the governor's ask for roadside testing. Everybody wants people safe on the road. However, my understanding is that on the tax and regulate bill, they're going to want warrants issued, which is another problem. I mean, we're putting a lot of faith and empowerment in law enforcement to say that they are the key people to say, okay, probable cause is there, we're the determining factor, and let's get warrants and so on. I have concerns about that. I think that the governor also is not going to be as satisfied with the warrants and saliva test as written. I think that the governor, from my discussions with administration, said he would prefer the blood testing, which of course is also already there in the criminal process. And, you know, it's the same situation. How do you put a good roadside test for something that, in my understanding, actually stays in your system for 30 days or longer? And how do you actually stop interfering with people's rights? And it's so pervasive. I mean, blood testing and saliva testing is such a pervasive thing into a person's privacy and their rights. So what's the way? I mean, are there better solutions? Perhaps the better solution is to take the tax and regulate and make sure that there are clubs where people go. Turn in your keys, you go and you pay a membership fee, and that's where you can, you know, go and partake. And that's a good way to generate revenue, because there will be corporations set up and bonds and so on, and it's safe, and then you turn back their keys when they're allowed to leave, and otherwise people will be in their homes. But there are so many issues here. So the one part that I heard, which I am very much against, is throw in the saliva testing and warrants and let the courts figure it out. Okay. I think as legislators, that's the most irresponsible thing we could do. I'm so tired of hearing, let the courts figure it out. Let's burden the courts with everything and not give the courts enough money. And let's just write bad law. I think we need to write good law. So I think this is one of the examples of another piece of legislation that needs to be fleshed out. I personally do not believe in the saliva test. I personally do not believe of such a strong empowerment for law enforcement on this particular issue. I think it is too complex, and we need to be very careful. I think we need to find a better way for roadside safety. I'd like to see more education done in the school system, in the high school, so that the young adults understand what can happen. But I don't think that the saliva testing with warrants is the way to go.
One last of these sort of quote-unquote big bills I just wanted to discuss real quick was the school lead, school water, lead in water testing. Sounds like there's been a lot of discussion back and forth about where to set the limit. Should it be one part per million or one part per billion or three or five? Is this something you see that the legislature is going to be able to coalesce around a common bill of some sort and get it to the governor's desk by adjournment date?
I think that bill has already started to take good movement. It started out in the education committee, and it was put together starting out with 100% funding from the state, and then it got down to a split vote. And it came out at 70-30.
So 70% would be state
revenue
and
30% by the schools.
By the school district.
Okay. However, that bill now was sent over to the Human Services Committee, and good for them, okay, because they fleshed it out and they brought it back to 100% reimbursements of the actual cost. And they had a cap so that you would get 100% up to the cap, and then the schools would pay thereafter if they didn't hit the cap. And so if the school that the provider didn't if they went over the cap, then they would be responsible for the difference. Mm. So I think that, yes, now that the Human Services Committee has taken it and gone with the minority vote, it was a big difference in the vote. I think it was like 7-6, 7-4, the 70-30, and 6 for the 100%. Human Services went closer to the minority vote, and tried to repair it to get it back up to 100%, coming up with a bit of a compromise with the cap. And so I think it will come out, and I'm thinking that will definitely go forward.
Well, I'm sure it's one of those bills that everybody can agree. Nobody wants lead in school drinking water. It's just a question of how to be paid for it.
Yeah, but and also, how do you repair it?
Yeah, right.
I mean, what do you do? And so all of that is going to look at each school individually. What does each school have to do? Who is going to do the repairs? So that's where I said the caps will come in and then, you know, they'll figure it out. But at least there, Human Services did flesh it out, you know, and take the minority vote out of the education and follow that one. Because I think everybody really wanted the 100%, as close we could get to the 100%, so that taxation wouldn't hit at the local property tax level and it would, you know, start at the taxpayers at the state.
Well, certainly a to-be-continued kind of thing here. So meanwhile, there are a couple of other little, I guess I call them quirky sort of bills, different stuff, kind of a little unusual, kind of interesting while we're being fixated with minimum wage and tax and regulate and family leave and the others. The legislature also voted to eliminate all references to slavery in the Vermont Constitution. Why was this considered something necessary?
Well, so I'm not going to say necessary because we all have a vote. So we all want, you know, there to be no slavery, especially me,
right,
who
this wouldn't change anything.
Human trafficking, right?
Yeah, the 13th Amendment of the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, outlawed slavery. So
correct. So I think Vermont. What I've seen is that they are a very aggressively brave state, and they have a strong moral code. And I think that this murmur of removing slavery started again, at least I know it last session, I don't know, maybe even before. So do you eliminate, though, historically, everything that has happened and start with a new slate? Are we saying this is the year that we're going to rewrite a new history? Like, do we erase the Vietnam War? Do we erase Columbus Day? Do we erase everything and start anew? I think the opportunity with the new constitutional proposition is that it's not just about slavery. I believe it's also the reproductive rights issue that's included in this constitutional change. So I think what they're doing now is they brought those two issues forward, thinking, let's vote on the constitutional change, get those two issues in it. I don't know the feel for the majority of the legislators on a constitutional change. I don't know if they understand the gravity of what a constitutional change is, because when somebody within the House majority tries to get you to vote for something, they want you to see the positives. Constitutional change is a big lift.
And this would be something that voters themselves will have the final say on, right? It will be a constitutional amendment that would have to go to the regular voters.
Right. However, it does carry forward. It takes like 5 years for it to happen. So there will be another in 2020. We don't even know what legislators will be there to continue the process.
Interesting.
So it's starting here, and this is something that is going forward, and you may be interviewing a whole bunch of new legislators.
Well, it certainly is interesting on that sort of, you know, constitutional level. The other one that kind of was fascinating was the change of name of, speaking of Columbus Day, to Indigenous Peoples Day. I guess no harm, no foul and all of that, but everyone kind of thinks of Columbus Day as, you know, Columbus Day. And now, was this something that had been building up for a while behind the scenes that finally made it over the finish line this year?
I think so. I think many of these issues started, you know, the murmur started before this session. So once again, you know, there are historical statements about historical people that some people don't like. And so does that mean you eliminate it? I mean, do we eliminate the Holocaust memories or talking about it? Do we eliminate Columbus Day? It happened. Okay, mm-hmm. So it passed the House, and for all the reasons, yes, you know, people said this particular person was horrific, this particular person did all the things that human beings shouldn't do. But then again, do we remove that? So it went to a vote, and it passed the House. I will tell you that there is a short bill out there to give Italian Americans their day. So that should be coming out in January, and we'll see if that makes up for Columbus.
Well, okay, we'll follow that one then. The third and last one of these sort of unusual little bills that kind of caught my eye anyway was this bill, and I don't know off the top of my head of where it stands legislatively yet, but to give non-residents voting rights in the town of Montpelier. And that would be just for state elections, not for national elections. But it sounds like there's a bit of controversy about that. I've read a certain amount of documents at this point, both pro and con. There really seem to be strong arguments on both sides. If I recall correctly, I think Brattleboro passed a similar measure a year or so ago, if I'm not mistaken, or at least we're considering one. What's the story here? Is that going to be a bill that will see the light of day?
Well, I believe it will pass. I think that, personally, I think that voting and jury duty belong to citizens. I think that that is something you do not sever. You should be a U.S. citizen to have those rights. I was not convinced with the number of non-citizen voters that would surface for Montpelier. I was not convinced with the fact that their profiles would not be clearly visible on documentations, the paperwork for the clerks. But I think that we want non-citizens to become citizens. And I think the more we give them this opportunity, we're telling them, don't become a naturalized citizen. Stay away. So I had many issues with that from a legal standpoint, as well as rights that are vested within citizenship. And I want them to become citizens. But I don't think throwing this type of bill out there, because maybe it'll be one person who votes, maybe it'll be 100 people, let them become citizens. And more likely than not, the process to become a citizen will be shorter than changing this particular constitution. The other problem I had was they're going to take an oath. So now the oath will have to be changed. But I don't think that the proponents of the bill looked at first the requirements of the Constitution to be allowed to take the oath. So what are the qualifications? And the qualifications are you must be a Vermont citizen to take the oath. So are you so I think there's more, once again, legal issues that were not looked at that should have been looked at. But to me, as I said, jury duty and the right to vote, I believe, belong to the U.S. citizens, and I welcome them to become U.S. citizens.
And one of the concerns that's been expressed, as you mentioned, was that it would sort of be a really easy way to identify who a non-citizen is, and that certainly opens up a bit of a can of worms. I guess I'm just wondering what is the argument for the proponents of this make? I mean, is it just that is it the idea that these folks are here? They assumably most of them have green cards or are legally landed. They have an interest, obviously, in how their locality runs, how the town operates, and tax rates and all the rest of it. So therefore, this is a way for them to have a voice rather than be kind of stuck on the sidelines until they finally become officially citizens?
I think the argument is we want them engaged. We want them to feel welcome in our town. So if we let you vote on this token level, okay, you can be engaged. Well, they are engaged. They have children in schools. They go to PTA meetings, I'm hoping. They participate in the town meetings anyway. They can go there and listen, and they can voice their opinions. Nobody's telling them they can't speak. So I think that we want them to be engaged and participate in the community, and we're going to do that and welcome them into our town. Well, you do that and help them become citizens. Mm. Walk them through the process. Get them a mentor. Help them understand the language if that's a barrier. Help them understand, you know, the civics. Help them become a citizen. And I think that's the better way to do it.
We have a couple of minutes left, and the origin of our conversation today was around a bill that you were a co-sponsor of last year on human trafficking, that I know has been a big issue, a big area of interest to you since before you arrived in the State House. And I guess I just wondered, you know, human trafficking is one of those things that most of us probably never really associate with happening in Vermont very much, but clearly it does. And I guess I just wondered, what has been your sense so far of how effective that bill or statute has been? Has it been... Do we have some data to support the idea that it's had an effect and doing some good?
So there's definitely been a valuable tool added to the legal defense. There's no question about that. I haven't tracked cases, so I don't know how many cases. But I do know that other states are actually taking that bill and amending their laws to abide by that. I think the key is that any tool that we can give for legal defense of trafficking victims is going to make a difference. Because now that particular bill has opened up the door for somebody who may have been identified as a trafficking victim and was not allowed to have that legal defense, now has it. Plus, any child born to a trafficking victim is now protected under that bill. So, of course, that's a huge tool for legal defense. You know, human trafficking is unconscionable. And it's here in Vermont. It's in all of the states. And if we pretend it's not here in Vermont, then it will grow. The underground will grow. What the new proposed bill is to get the businesses involved and have the businesses educate their employees. There are specific businesses that are more prone to trafficking, more visible trafficking. Remember, we have labor trafficking, we have sex trafficking, and so we also have the Mann Act where people cross the border, so it's a violation of the Mann Act. So all of that, the businesses need to become accountable for as well. They're hiring people. They should inform their employees. We have alleged massage parlors, of course, that's open, nail salons, they say. We don't know what goes on behind scenes, but there are red alerts just in hotels and motels. You know, you can have somebody who comes and says, can I get a room? And I only want to pay cash, but I want to be near an exit. You know, that's something you might want to just alert your employees of, and they can document it. How often does it happen? And then they could report that to a manager. And, you know, we don't want them to violate any of their business codes. We don't want them to take action because we want them to be safe as well, but we want them educated. The more people are educated and become aware, the less human trafficking will happen in Vermont. Mm.
Well, yeah, it really is something you don't really think of going on here. But, you know, obviously, like you say, happens in all 50 states. So anyway, very important subject. Thank you so much, Representative Sullivan, for being with us today and giving us the update on things that are happening up in Montpelier. We'll certainly be following along as we grind our way towards adjournment 4 or so weeks from now.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always great to be here with you.
My pleasure. And thanks for you folks for joining us today as well. I hope you found the show interesting, and we'll see you again the next time. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.